From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
They had offered a substantial sum of money, but it wasn't a substantial sum of money for a period drama.
Given what you wanted to do, right. I'm guessing this is the biggest budget you've ever had.
You're guessing correctly.
Documentarian Errol Morris came up with a new form of filmmaking to tell the story of Frank Olson, an Army scientist who died in mysterious circumstances in 1953. For his new series, Wormwood, Morris used interviews and archival footage, but also cast Peter Sarsgaard to play Olson in extended scripted sequences. Netflix went for the idea. Morris tells us about the making of the six-part series, Wormwood, which involves the CIA, LSD, the Korean War, and even sequences from Hamlet. But first on the news banter, Fox may be on the block. Meanwhile, the studio bounces director Bryan Singer. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, normally we're sort of winding down a little for the holidays, but so much is going on. I'm going to start talking just briefly. This Murdoch sale of the 21st Century Fox assets to Disney seems to be a thing, gaining steam. Murdoch has expressed his wish to have Bob Iger remain at Disney after they sell, which I think is kind of, I guess he can make that a condition of the sale, but, you know, that's like controlling beyond the sale, you know, like I'm going to keep you in your seat. And Iger, you know, I got to think his appetite for politics may be diminishing because he doesn't seem to take criticism well, so maybe he's decided he just may as well stay. But if this happens, it would redraw the map of Hollywood.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in addition to ownership of the studios going from six down to five, it would redraw a lot of the lines on who would work together and which companies would put out what kind of content. I mean, what they're talking about is a sale of the Fox Film Studio, the Fox Television Studio, the networks such as FX, Nat Geo, the stakes that Fox has in Hulu, which would give Disney a majority stake of Hulu. Sky in Europe would also, that stake would go to Disney. What the Murdochs would keep would be Fox News, Fox Sports, and a couple of other things, and they would potentially combine those with their newspaper properties into a private company that then they would continue to own. But this would completely redraw the map and raise a bunch of questions. You know, everything from, will the X-Men superheroes all of a sudden start showing up in the Avengers, to, you know, will companies like Fox Searchlight, which does smaller independent style movies, would those continue to exist under the Disney banner where they don't really care about that stuff? All the reporting we've seen is that Fox would continue to operate these assets as they are in the short term, but in the long term, who knows what's going to happen?
Well, I suspect that's some pretty valuable property on the west side where the Fox lot is. I mean, I just don't think it's smart to bet that this goes on. I mean, they're operating all of this stuff separately over the long term. Also an animation question. You know, Fox has animation. They did Ice Age movies and others. You know, this is a bad thing for animators who already don't have that many places to work making feature films. So,
well, what's hovering over all of this is Disney sees what's going on with Netflix and Amazon and other big tech players like Apple and is terrified. These companies are so big and they are getting into the content business, and Disney feels it needs to reshape itself, get bigger and more digital focused to compete with these big technology companies.
Now, going to a completely different topic, but staying with Fox, Fox has fired Bryan Singer off of the movie he was making about Queen, which is Bohemian Rhapsody. Rami Malek is the star, you know, from Mr. Robot. By all accounts, one of the nicest young men in the industry. I've met him at a party, very lovely. Bryan Singer, apparently a lot less lovely. You know, he seemed disengaged on his last several movies. He's been a problem, honestly, for, you know, I'd say probably three out of the last three movies. This is an unusual thing to fire somebody 2 weeks before the shooting is done, but Fox took that step.
Yeah, and from our reporting, he had gotten in some altercations with the cast and crew. He had gone AWOL. And the question I've had over this is, how did Bryan Singer get this job in the first place? Mm-hmm. Because his behavior is pretty well known throughout the industry. I mean, you've reported on some of the stuff that he did on Superman and Superman Returns, that film he directed, and he's been at the center of a lot of claims for some of his personal behavior. But the professional stuff has spilled into it. And I wonder why Fox took a chance on this guy.
Well, I do know the rationale that was put forward by Emma Watts, who's vice chairman of the studio, which was that this is a passion project of his and therefore he would focus. And supposedly he was sternly warned that any bad behavior would be met with swift punishment. Now, I agree with what you're basically saying, which is why is the talent so great and the risk so worth it? And I would say most people would say no. I know people inside the studio didn't think so. And I think there's another factor, too, which is that as the Harvey Weinstein stuff broke and there was story after story, they know that Bryan Singer has been looked at with respect to this and nobody has ever confirmed anything. There was an accuser who went away and sort of disintegrated. But they were concerned, I am told, about what the red carpet would be like and how you could have this person out there when one of his friends, Gary Goddard, who had sort of dodged a bullet with the previous accuser, had been called out recently by Anthony Edwards with support.
And he stepped down from his company.
He stepped down. So, you know, you can see how they might have thought they were sailing into winds in the first place, and then the winds became like gale force.
Right. And that's interesting because it suggests that these harassment scandals and these personal behavior scandals are going to start impacting the choices that studios make when hiring and promoting and putting people into movies because they know that they are going to have to address this stuff going forward.
And I'll turn just to one last thing, which is a very extensive New York Times report following Ronan Farrow's report about how Harvey Weinstein went about his business. And this story, in part, focused the beams on CAA and its conduct. And there has been a lot of, I'm sure you've heard the talk, as I have in Hollywood, you know, what did CAA know? Which agents, not just at CAA, potentially sent people into meetings with somebody like Harvey Weinstein, knowing that this is potentially incredibly risky. I'll note, Harvey Weinstein continues to say he did nothing wrong, just for the record. CAA, meanwhile, comes out with this statement, which I'll read in part. They say they apologize, quote, to any person the agency let down for not meeting the high expectations we place in ourselves, close quote. And they're going to maybe try and put more women into management and, improve its policies there. But I have to say, apologizing that they didn't meet their own standards when you potentially sent people into harm's way, I don't know what they could have said, but that just doesn't land for me.
Yeah, I mean, this whole scandal just does not make representatives look very good. I mean, we've had actresses come forward and say, you know, I told my agent specifically about this. And the fact that they did nothing really says a lot about the culture of the industry. And yes, agents, their job is to get the client a job.
Yes, and, but, you know, right.
And they would probably argue that anything they would have done would have prevented the client from getting a job, and that's not what their role is. But, you know, there is a larger moral, if not a legal obligation to say something if you know that this behavior is going on.
Well, and, you know, William Morris had suspended Adam Bennett, who represents Adam Sandler and others, saying there was a duty to protect their client, Terry Crews. Well, they brought him back in a month. Terry Crews is now suing them. And I think what we're seeing at these agencies is that these partners have had so much freedom to do whatever for so long in this culture that when one of them is in the crosshairs, as Adam Bennett was, and people at CAA probably should be, they have mutually assured destruction because they know too much about what they've been doing. And they can say, if you want to take me on, I will turn the tables. And that's why I think we've seen such paralysis at these agencies, even though it's kind of one of those open secrets again that some of these agents are probably problems.
Yeah, and I don't know what they're going to do about it. I will say that when you talk to people at these agencies, they're getting the message. I mean, they are hyper sensitive about this stuff now. I mean, who knows what happened in the past, but they are doing their best to change that culture. I don't know if it can be changed, but they are doing their best.
I mean, the key is that they have to continue doing their best, and this cannot be transitory. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter.
What were you told at the time of your father's death?
I was told that your father has had an accident. But that was the cover story. told by the CIA.
That's documentary filmmaker Errol Morris speaking to Eric Olson, a man obsessed with uncovering the real story of his father's death in Morris's new multi-part Netflix series, Wormwood. Eric Olson grew up believing his father, Frank, an Army scientist with connections to the CIA, had committed suicide by jumping out of a Manhattan hotel window in 1953, when Eric was 9 years old. But in 1975, newly released CIA files added a wrinkle to the story. Shortly before his death, Frank Olson may have been part of a CIA experiment in which he was given LSD without his knowledge. Of course, that came as shocking news to Eric and his family.
They take him to New York Tuesday morning, early Saturday morning, he's dead. What was my father doing? What was the CIA doing? What happened there?
Eric Olson has devoted his life to pursuing answers to those questions, and in Wormwood, Morris put forth what Olson has discovered, one layer at a time. What makes the series unique is that it presents the story of Olson not only through interviews and archival footage, but through scripted dramatic performances, with Peter Sarsgaard playing doomed scientist Frank Olson. In one scene, CIA agents take Olson, severely shaken, perhaps because of the secret LSD experiment, to see a doctor played by Bob Balaban.
So, how am I supposed to help you? Is this a problem where you're thinking the wrong thoughts and I'm supposed to help you think the right ones?
I can't live up to anyone's expectations. At home, work. Can't keep doing what I've been doing.
Given Morris's hybrid technique, it's tough to say exactly how to categorize Wormwood. What do we call your film? We call it a series or a film?
You have to help me out here.
Okay.
Nomenclature.
Yes.
What is it?
What is it in
what
the era of
what kind of animal are we dealing with here?
Yes.
Is it a film? Is it a series? Is it something else altogether?
Yeah. Well, so I'm interested in a lot of things about it, but let me start with, when did you come up with the idea to do this particular thing that we will call a film?
I remember coming into the old Netflix offices when they were still a small company with two or three people. And I met with Lisa Nishimura.
Right, their head of documentary.
And Adam Del Deo. And I told them I wanted to do the Everything Bagel. It was going to have straight drama, scripted drama. It was going to have reenactments. And I like to distinguish between reenactments and scripted drama.
A performance, yeah.
And it was going to have interviews. It was going to have archival material. It was going to have home movies.
So you go in and say, I want to do an Everything Bagel. And they say, yes?
They say yes without really knowing what yes means.
Well, how could they?
They couldn't. And over time, it was an ongoing struggle to define what it is, and a struggle to get Netflix to pay for it. They had offered a substantial sum of money, but it wasn't a substantial sum of money for a period drama.
Given what you wanted to do, right. I'm guessing this is the biggest budget you've ever had.
You're guessing correctly.
Okay. It was an easy guess, honestly. But when you go out to Peter Sarsgaard and you say, I'm making this Everything Bagel, would you like to be in it? How does that work out?
I always wanted Peter Sarsgaard to play Frank Olson. I've always been a fan. I approach him after we've shot the interviews, I believe. And he was appearing in Hamlet.
How perfect.
Kind of perfect.
And I will just say that Hamlet is a definite recurring theme in this film. So he was in Hamlet, and that was perfect.
And I remember seeing An Education for the first time. Mm. And there's a scene at the very end of the movie where he's sitting in a car. He doesn't go in.
Right.
And it's absolutely quiet. It's absolutely still. And the performance is extraordinarily powerful. I liked it.
So you wanted him to be Frank Olson.
I did.
Was he an easy yes, I don't quite get what it is, but I'll do it, or did he need to be persuaded?
I think he wanted to work with me for whatever godforsaken reason.
Yeah, I think a lot of people's attention would be caught by the idea of doing something with you and something unusual.
So he did say yes, and it took a while before we could get all of this together to the point where we were shooting. But he said he wanted to do it, and he never changed his mind.
Now, did you have to go back to Netflix and try to up the budget every so often?
I had to go back to Netflix and up the budget once we had decided on a script and that we were shooting and casting actors. And a lot of actors, actually.
Bob Balaban and others, yeah.
Yeah.
So the interview parts were done first.
Yes, with multiple cameras, which was another innovation in this film. The interview with Eric Olsen was actually done with 10 cameras.
10? It's a lot of cameras.
It's a lot of cameras.
Why that choice?
Because of collage.
Ah, and that's his thing. He's a psychologist who deals in collage.
Part of it.
Part of it, okay.
An important part of it, admittedly. But detective work, I was a private detective for years. Because after I made Gates of Heaven in Vernon, Florida, no one would hire me.
Ah.
So I had to earn a living. I was a private detective in New York.
So the detective aspect informed the multiple cameras because...
Well, detective work is stitching stuff together.
Yeah, it's a mosaic.
You're trying to take the evidence that you have from interviews, from documents, et cetera, and piece them together with a picture of reality.
Right, distill them into something that seems true.
So it's a metaphor. Is that a bad thing? I never know whether metaphors are good or bad.
I think it depends on the context, yeah.
Yeah. It's a metaphor that runs through the whole story.
So the Olsen saga, the Frank saga, came to your attention how and when?
Netflix was interested in MKUltra.
This is the CIA project in which people were allegedly fed LSD.
Well, programmed behavior modification.
Right.
Sometimes it's thought of as their Manchurian Candidate program.
I was gonna say, yeah.
And it becomes even more mysterious because they destroyed all the records.
Right. Makes it hard.
Makes it very, very, very hard.
But although we're led to believe there are records squirreled away.
There are records here and there, and they've been able to piece together a story about MKUltra.
Mm-hmm.
God knows how many people have been implicated in MKUltra, from Charles Manson to Lee Harvey Oswald to Ted Kaczynski, and on and on and on and on. So, yeah, I came in the door with an MKUltra project. I started one. It didn't work out. The guy wouldn't sign a release. And I knew they still wanted a project.
Did you come in with like a portfolio and what about this one? What about that one?
No, I came in with one. And I shot something, which is one of the better things I've ever done. And I couldn't use it.
That's irritating, yeah.
Yes. And so then I started this project with Eric Olsen without really fully understanding what was involved.
I mean, how did he come to your attention?
MKUltra. I'm reading.
You're reading and you see that there's this guy, Frank Olsen, who got dead and somehow.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he went out a window, but...
And the son is alive and the son is spent...
Not only alive, but obsessed with this.
Obsessed is kind of an understatement. Obsessed with the circumstances of his father's death.
So you went and found him and said, "Hi, I'm the guy you've been waiting for."
I'm not sure I said exactly that in those words, but yes, I said hi, and we worked out a deal for him to make this movie.
And he must have been thrilled to at least find someone who was going to give him this forum. He's been at this for decades.
He's been interviewed by a fair number of people, but nothing like this.
Yeah, nothing ever gets into near the end zone, it seems to me, until now.
So this seemed exceptionally rich to me. All of these interwoven stories, like Russian dolls, stories within stories within stories. The story of Frank Olsen, the Korean War, the possible use of
biological weapons.
Weapons. We know nothing. It's really quite interesting. We know nothing about the history of our involvement with Korea.
And most Americans have assumed that there's not much to know, right? They just don't think about it in those terms, I think.
That's correct.
So you have now got Eric Olsen. He's ready to go. And you sit down and interview him for, I'm sure, many hours. Many hours.
3 days, maybe 6 or 7 hours a day.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
You then are moving on, and again, Netflix has signed on to this. You knew, obviously you needed footage that would be recreation or, dramatic presentation of, because you can't just have this guy talking for that many hours, and it's a story where there isn't a lot of footage for you to just pull from archives to cover what went on in that hotel room, for example. You have to make that. You decide to do it theatrically. And
it's a little different than that. Yes, the need to show things that you could not show otherwise. But what really fascinated me is that if you look through all of the CIA documents, they were narratives.
Oh, they were first-person
narratives that told a story that didn't quite make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And like all good lies, you're always told that good lies always contain an element of the truth. It gives them kind of respectability. And that was true in this case. And I wanted to bring to life the CIA version that was at the heart of this whole story. An ironic use of drama where what you're being told quite possibly is not true.
Coming up after a short break, director Errol Morris tells us there might be more Wormwood in the future and questions the ever-changing rules that govern what is and what isn't eligible for Best Documentary at the Oscars. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to filmmaker Errol Morris about his new documentary and scripted hybrid miniseries, Wormwood. All six parts of the four-hour opus will be available on Netflix starting December 15th. Wormwood seeks to uncover what really happened to Army scientist Frank Olson in 1953, when he jumped, fell, or was pushed out of a window in a Manhattan hotel. Morris uses scripted dramatic performances with well-known actors to illuminate what was concealed and what was eventually revealed about Olson's death. He also uses in-depth interviews with Olson's son, Eric, as well as a memorable encounter with renowned reporter Seymour Hersh, who's been investigating the Olson case on and off for decades. By now, Hersh has his own theory about the case, but he says he's never been able to publish a definitive account without putting his source in danger.
If I publish what I knew, I make somebody into a Snowden. That's one thing. And secondly, even if I publish what I knew, I have to have somebody else saying something. But do I believe something heinous happened to Olson? Yes.
I'm trying to picture the two of you together.
He's cranky.
So how is that?
We're friends now. He loves the movie. He was convinced he was going to hate the movie. And he watched it with his kids and his wife. And everyone loves the movie.
So I wonder, I have this idea in my head, because in the movie, he tells you there are certain things he cannot tell you, which I understand. He was worried about putting a source at risk. I just have this idea that you turned off the cameras and then he told you. Did he?
What makes you think that?
Just a feeling.
I know more than I'm willing to say.
I figured.
So he made an interesting point to me. And talking about Citizen Four and about Snowden, that you don't do that. It's a misunderstanding of leaks, secret sources who are unnamed. You leave them in place.
Of course you do.
You leave them in place and you let them leak.
Yes.
Let them leak.
Why
and
would
then
you ever
leak
expose
some
a
more.
Source? The information is a lot
Why
more interesting.
Why would you ever expose a source?
No, I had no issue whatsoever with that.
And, you know, Tsai has been endlessly criticized for using unnamed, unidentified sources. And he said to me over the years, you know, my editors always know the names of the sources.
Yeah.
It's not like it's a secret, but it's a secret.
It's a need to know. Who needs to know?
And if the source was identified, what would happen? They get arrested. So if Cy tells me that I shouldn't do this, I mean, I thought a long time about it. You know, I know this, I know that. Why should I just do what Cy wants me to do? And I don't think I've done what Cy wants me to do. I have, in effect, done what Cy wants me to do, but I believe it's the correct thing to do. How about that?
You got at the story without putting him on the spot, basically.
And I'm not done with it.
Oh, he's not done, ladies and gentlemen. I'm interested in hear more about that.
I mean, yes, I want to go on and make other things, but there's unfinished business here. There's a
with
story.
Netflix, though? Like a sequel?
Well, who else? I don't know. They're invested in this thing.
Yeah, just as long as they stay the course. I mean, would that be your next thing? More Wormwood? Wormier Wood?
I think that there might be an epilogue. Mm. I don't think there's another six-part series or film to be extracted from this story. But there is an epilogue that does interest me.
I'll let my imagination chew on that for a minute. So the theatrical release, how did that come to be?
It came to be because we had talked about it at pre-Telluride. It's interesting. They decided that they wanted to qualify it for an Oscar. So we created a version of it where we basically took off all the end credits, made some changes, took off the head credits, and created a movie version
that
could be shown in theaters.
But it's still not qualified, or is it?
No.
That's not good enough.
Not good enough. Sorry, Errol. Wormwood was not considered eligible for the Oscars this year.
This is the Ezra Edelman blowback because the O.J. series was a film, a TV show slash film.
Probably that's part of it. What's so odd, and it is odd. I mean, I was fortunate. I got an Oscar.
Yes.
Whoopee-doo.
Well, some people want one.
I wanted one.
Okay.
You kidding me?
I'm not kidding. No, I'm sure you did. Everybody does. No matter how they act like they're too cool for school, everybody wants an Oscar.
The one main benefit of getting an Oscar is you don't have to feel bitter about not having gotten an Oscar because you did get one.
Yes. You have that thing.
So there. When I first started making documentaries, whatever it was, 1,000 years ago, when I first started making them, there was no such thing as theatrical distribution for nonfiction. I did it, but it was considered to be peculiar.
Mm.
But then all of a sudden, when documentaries became more popular, there were certainly more of them, then they set this requirement that documentaries should be in theaters.
Right.
They were never in theaters. Never, ever, 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 ever in theaters. So there's this requirement, and then all of a sudden, people start four-walling these films. So they show them a week in New York, and they show them a week in Los Angeles, and
right.
They qualify for the Oscars.
Right. It's a bit of a game.
Bit of a game. It's very much a game, and a kind of odd game, because you could say that it's disingenuous. They're really not theatrical films at all.
Right. It's a release with a wink.
A release with a wink. Yeah.
Yeah. Errol Morris is the director of Wormwood. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance this week from Kat Yore. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.